WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work blends classroom learning with extensive field education guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
We made it to the end of the week. Yay, us! Let's take a look back at the local news you need to know but might have missed. It's time for our weekly news recap. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset.
Mayor Brandon Johnson continues pushing Chicago Public Schools to reimburse the city for a $175 million pension payment.
The school district must begin to take on some of the responsibilities since it wants to call all of its own shots. It wants to do all of its own things.
The firefighters and the teachers are without contracts. We are going to push forward for a city that honors the people who do the work.
The parties will continue to work through the three remaining priorities: veteran educator pay, elementary teacher planning time, and teacher evaluation.
Here to take us behind the week's headlines, we had Simone Alisea, executive producer of CityCast Chicago, the daily podcast and newsletter. Alex Nitkin, government finance and accountability reporter with the Illinois Answers Project from the Better Government Association. And Nader Issa, education reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times. Our first story: the clock is ticking for Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson to find a way to cover a $175 million pension bill. Nader began with getting us up to speed.
You said the clock is ticking, and at this point it feels like you're like in a torture room or something, and it's just ticking, 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 and you can't get that tick out of your head, because it's been about a year of negotiations between CPS and CTU, and this pension payment has been, since August, a big deal between CPS and the mayor's
office.
Has
it been that long? Jeez.
Yeah, it's been one story dominating education for that long in Chicago. And, you know, there was this deadline that the mayor's office was saying was so crucial of Monday. They needed this payment from CPS. It's $175 million. It reimburses part of a pension payment that City Hall makes to a pension fund, because there are, you know, some CPS staffers who aren't teachers in that pension fund.
Yes.
But Pedro Martinez, the CPS CEO, he's refused to make it. He said CPS doesn't have the money to do it this year because they need to pay for a CTU contract and a new contract with the brand new shiny principals union. And so there's just been this standoff. It sort of hasn't moved. And there's this deadline on Monday because the city needs the revenue in order to close its books in the black.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't seem that it's going to come.
Well, what are the mayor's choices if he doesn't find a way to get this done by the deadline?
He's got some tricky ones. What the sort of prevailing thought has been is that they'll go and dip into the city's reserves. There's some question of whether that needs city council approval or not. You know, that was done with the migrant crisis last year, and there was some commotion, city council saying the mayor did that without our approval. That seems to be, you know, the top solution, but they have between now and June, the mayor's office said, to sort of scrape together what they can, see if other revenue streams brought in more funding than they thought they would last fiscal year, and sort of try to cover the books that way.
What do you think about these choices, Alex? Because, I mean, he's an already politically embattled mayor.
Absolutely. There are really no good options here. And it's worth noting that we're talking about closing the books on the 2024 fiscal year, while the mayor is busy trying to stare down what could potentially be a $1 billion budget deficit looking ahead to next year and starting next year's budget deficit. So this is the last thing that he wants to be worrying about. I think it was last week or maybe the week before, he had a big press conference with Jill Jaworski, the city CFO, kind of outlining, here is exactly the ways that we want CPS to make up for this pension payment. They can take on this short-term debt. And they were really pressed by reporters, well, what if they don't accept that? And they didn't really have a lot to say. It's like, no, we think this is the way to go. And so not many good options. Sure, one is to dip into the city's reserves, but that, of course, risks, you know, raising the hackles of credit rating agencies who mm-hmm. are already, you know, have shown they're willing to downgrade the city's credit once.
I'm sure you've been paying attention to that ongoing battle between Mayor Johnson and the public school CEO on this, Simone.
Oh, yeah. I mean, to everyone's point, the trick here is, you know, you want to talk about rocks and hard places. Like, here we are, right? Yeah. There just sort of really isn't, you know, an obvious solution here. And then on top of that, of course, you also have kind of the political implications of, you know, Johnson coming to this office, you know, from CT, right, as a former CTU organizer, right, obviously, you know, had served on the Cook County Commission, but you know, he is so closely associated with the Chicago Teachers Union, and it was sort of thought that, like, surely schools will be easy for him to get his agenda
not so
done,
much.
And that is not really happening.
Yeah. Well, Nader, make it clear, city council's role in all of this. I mean, does the mayor actually need their approval to move $175 million around in that budget?
A lot of reporters asked the mayor's aides, top aides this week, and they just say they're not sure. And I think it's
interesting.
Unclear. You know, you ask some alder people, like Bill Conway is one. He is really adamant this is something that would need to be brought before city council and be approved. And the mayor's office is sort of just wishy-washy. They're not even saying what they would do to fill in the gap. And and then they're saying, you know, based on what we decide to do, we could need to go to city council. We could not. It's really not clear right now.
I want to stick with schools and money because, again, this is the story that just keeps on giving here. We keep being told Chicago teachers are on the cusp of finalizing their contract, but it doesn't seem to be happening. What's the holdup?
I don't know.
What are they telling you? What are they texting
the
you?
The education reporter is stumped.
We're trying to get the same answers because we're being told it's close, and then we tell
what
the public
is going
it's
on?
Close. You know, there are just a few thorny issues that are still being worked out. You know, we thought Wednesday night they stayed at the table until 11 p.m. or so. We thought, you know, they got close. It turns out they got pretty close, but not there. And then Thursday, we thought they were going to wrap it up, you know, hammer out the final details. That's what we were being told. And then still they didn't get there.
I'm just picturing you up late at night just watching
just
your phone.
Waiting on
trying
on a text.
To get updates.
So, you know, the three issues that they're still working out are extra pay for veteran teachers. Once they get later in their careers, you know, their pay sort of stagnates. There's extra planning time for elementary school teachers. Those are really two of the key issues. Mm-hmm. And they're there. They're basically there, but there are some finer details that still need to be worked out. And then the CTU, too, they have this process where they have a small bargaining team of their top leaders. They have a big bargaining team of rank and file members. Then they have their House of Delegates. That's about 500-600 elected representative members. And then they have their full union. And so they like to just take their time, go step by step, make sure everything's approved. And, you know, it could be
and
tomorrow,
in the meantime, we wait.
It could be Sunday. It
right.
could be Monday.
Well,
could
this
be
week,
Tuesday.
We saw the CTU join forces with the Firefighters Union this week in rallies. Here's a bit of what Firefighters Union President Pat Cleary had to say.
We need a contract. We've been without a contract for 4 years. Back when the police finally got their contract, some of their contract issues went back to 2017. That's not acceptable. And then for the teachers now, they're coming up on a year. This is not acceptable. This is about unity, coming together, getting benefits.
All right. Well, they have been, the firefighters, without a contract for more than 3.5 years, Nader. Were you surprised at all, though, to see the two groups sort of join forces?
The CTU called it historic. You know, that historic's thrown around a lot. But it they're not two unions that you would have expected
to come together
to rally. And so, yeah, it was cool to see. You know, they're coming from different corners and supporting each other. Mm-hmm. And there were you know, CTU leaders who made the point, too, that there are teachers and firefighters in the same family, you know? Like, even though publicly we
That's
might
true.
Not view the teachers union, firefighters union hand in hand, they're all workers across the city
in real life.
And fighting for right. you know, workers' rights and pay and all
this
that.
This has got to put more pressure on the city to finalize both of these contracts, I would hope.
It seems like there's always pressure on the city to do things, but you know, who knows when it's going to happen. I keep saying, you know, I keep thinking about that school board vote to fire Pedro Martinez the Friday before Christmas.
Oh, right? I remember.
You know, the
Friday night.
The Friday
Christmas.
Night. Yes. I think it was like 9 p.m. as I recall.
All of the best criteria for making for a good public vote.
You know, so when it comes to pressure and timing, you know, this administration and this city is certainly no stranger to it. It's not unusual for things like this to happen. I think just the how long this has dragged out in the news and how nuanced it is, right?
Yeah.
It's so different from, you know, when you sort of had a mayor who was directly aligned with the CPS CEO, let alone you had a school board that wasn't partly elected. So
right.
you've got a lot more nuance going on in these discussions, I think.
So we got the firefighters and teachers in solidarity. But at the same time, we've got another influential union which had tough words for CTU leadership. What did the Service Employees International Union, or SEIU, have to say, Nader?
You know, this has always been one of the CTU's closest allies. If there was any other union other than the CTU that helped Brandon Johnson get elected, it was SEIU. And SEIU represents a lot of support staff workers at Chicago Public Schools. So when the CTU strikes, when SEIU's in negotiations, they usually are together. There has been this rift, though, the past few months over a CTU proposal that SEIU has said would sort of erode its ranks of special education classroom assistants. And they've just gone back and forth, you know, trading barbs. The SEIU has come out pretty forcefully, accused mm-hmm. the CTU of trying to raid its members. And the latest accusation is that, you know, Stacey Davis Gates bullied or intimidated Anthony Driver, a leader in SEIU.
Mm-hmm. And that was a quote. They said, quote, bullying and dishonesty
yeah.
is what they're alleging.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's all just symptomatic of this relationship sort of being a little tenuous right now. And they've sent the issue up about the CTU's proposals to the AFL-CIO to try to resolve it. But for now, there's just these like interpersonal disagreements and, like SEIU said, bullying yeah. and dishonesty.
One more school-related story before we take a break. South Suburban Dalton made plenty of headlines. This was over how taxpayer dollars were spent by former Mayor Tiffany Henyard. I'm looking at you, Alex. This week, the salary of the school superintendent was raising some eyebrows. What do we know about this?
Yeah, kind of a strange situation.
I mean, how much money
here?
Are we talking about here?
So we're talking about a $450,000 baseline current salary that is going to, under a current plan, increase by $30,000 over the next couple of years. The school board that is in charge of this was challenged on it, obviously, by, you know, people who, constituents who sort of got wise to this and like, why is it happening? They described it as this kind of weird perfect storm situation that basically they cannot find anyone else to do this job. And so they're paying him extra to keep him on. And
wow.
So I think that it's complicated with these questions of, you know, why are we paying public officials this much money? But it's a little bit hard to argue that they should be paid less when they're struggling so much to find people who are willing
to do these
very
important jobs.
Yeah,
that's a very good point. So he's going to end up making a $510,000 base salary at the end of this. Any idea, Nader, how that compares with other school superintendents? Is he way ahead of folks?
Well, we don't have to look far. You just go a little bit north to this big school district called Chicago, and the CEO makes around $360,000. Overseeing,
yeah.
you know, 320,000 students in 600 schools. So it
wow.
it is, you know, that number caught my eye, knowing what the Chicago schools CEO makes in, you know, other big city districts around the country.
Yeah, the former school superintendent of Calumet City made $432,000, and that was the most of any superintendent in Illinois until he was fired in 2019 for misconduct. But speaking of high salaries, yeah, there's more. I wonder how many of our listeners knew what the highest paid public job was in Chicago. Fill us in, Simone.
Choose Chicago CEO
is the highest paid public job in this city,
which is the for those who don't know, Choose Chicago is essentially the city's tourism arm. It is the agency that markets Chicago to the outside world to get people to come here and mm-hmm. spend money. And it's interesting because that position has been vacant since January 2024, and has been under an interim leader since then. And there has been a lot of back and forth over who to hire in that position, because, as you can imagine, since the pandemic, tourism has taken a big hit. We're still not at pre-pandemic levels.
Sure.
And it's costing, you know, that's a lot of money that we're leaving on the table there.
So they're making $520,000.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So and here it is again, Alex, another job that was hard to fill.
Exactly. It is obviously a very important job.
So people don't want to take $500,000?
I guess. I don't know. It's a lot of responsibility.
Marketing is hard, man.
Marketing is hard. You got to, you know, answer to a whole lot of people. It's arguably one of the most important jobs for the economic future.
I'm just saying, no one called
region.
Me.
Yeah.
No
I'm
one
sure
called and asked if I was interested.
You can put your name for it and try to undercut them. Yeah, I mean it's a big important job, and I guess if you ask them, they would just say, "Well, this is the market. This is the market for that position." I love to just point out during these conversations that the highest paid public employee in the state of Illinois is Brett Bielema, the football coach of the Illini.
Really?
$6.5 million made
Ooh.
Last year. So just to sort of keep everything in context.
Yeah.
You know, talk about what our priorities are for public funding of things.
Yeah, you think about like the chief marketing officer of the entire city of Chicago. Like their entire job is to market the city. And
True.
Like, if you were to imagine in the private sector, like that would be a very similar, you know, that figure is not insane, especially
yes.
when you compare it to the $6 million of a head coach of a football team.
So there's no surprise then that this is the highest paying government job in Chicago?
It's
a big job.
Yeah,
it's a big job.
I don't know, man.
Or the tens of millions of dollars that the city relies upon every year, conservatively, in tax dollars from tourism and conventions, especially.
Yeah.
It's important.
This week brought more White House drama or action, depending on how you look at it. I want to start with the 10,000 people laid off from the Department of Health and Human Services. Simone, let's bring it right here to home. How does HHS impact us here in Illinois?
Yeah. So when we're talking about health and human services, we're talking about a wide variety of things. You know, you want to talk sort of more on the ground stuff that people feel, mental health services, behavioral health, mm-hmm. and also substance abuse programs, right? There is funding that has been cut in Illinois to the tune of, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars mm-hmm. That will affect those kinds of programs. On top of that, you have things that would help us potentially respond better or predict a future pandemic and future epidemics, right? The preparedness of public health
right.
for something like that. That kind of funding and has also been affected both across Illinois and in Chicago specifically as well.
Yeah, the Illinois Department of Public Health lost $125 million, to your point there. And the Trump administration is also blocking another $324 million in future Illinois Public Health Department grants. Wow, not looking good there. The so-called Trump travel ban 2.0, yes, it's back. It may go into effect soon. On Wednesday, we saw immigrant rights supporters rallying against the ban down at Federal Plaza. I want to play a little bit of what Nadia Al-Yafe of the Arab American Action Network had to say.
It is clear this draft travel ban is not an isolated incident. It is an extension and continuation of ongoing attacks on immigrants and marginalized under the Trump regime.
So what are we hearing, Simone, about what this ban, this version of the ban might look like?
Yeah, it's interesting because this is sort of still in a draft. Like, there's still a lot that hasn't actually happened yet. It's a little unlike what had happened in 2017, where it just like the ban went into effect.
It came
airports
out of
were,
nowhere.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
This is a little different, I guess. Maybe, I don't know, maybe Trump's learned something to make it even worse. Who knows? But, you know, the New York Times put out a report that there could be, you know, as many as 43 different countries
yes,
targeted,
I saw that.
You know, where travel could be fully suspended or partially partially suspended. Some of the countries include, Afghanistan, Cuba, Iran, Syria, Venezuela. Mm-hmm.
I saw a bunch of Caribbean nations on there too. Surprised me. St. Lucia, Antigua and Barbuda.
Haiti as well.
Why?
Restricting visas from those countries. You know, the stated reason, right? It's all about security. It's all about, trying to crack down on the vetting of it all. But, mm-hmm. I think the trick is we've already been through this. We've already done this once before. It's kind of hard to, give any.
We've seen the playbook.
Exactly. Exactly. It is indeed a travel ban 2.0. But in this case, we don't quite know what the final outlines of it will be.
Well, whatever it's going to be, it looks like it's going to have a big imprint, that's for sure, with 40-something countries on that list. Trump's also taking aim, Alex, at another law firm, Chicago-based legal powerhouse Jenner and Block. What is this about?
This is part of a recent campaign from the Trump administration to sign this flurry of executive orders that target certain big, powerful law firms in certain ways to basically try to make their lives a lot harder, make their work harder by doing things like preventing them from talking to federal employees or going into federal buildings or getting security clearances and things like that to be able to deal, basically have any interface with the federal government, and things that, if they are carried out, would be really crippling for the activities of these really big, powerful national law firms. Jenner and Block is the latest one, big Chicago, we call it white shoe law firm. They have just filed a lawsuit basically saying, look, this is blatantly unconstitutional. You've come out and literally really just said, like, you are doing this as an act of retribution for our activities and what we have done. And you think that it's been too partisan, mm-hmm. To use a legal term, like an arbitrary and capricious, just like we are punishing you because we don't like what you're doing. That kind of strategy has shown some success already. Perkins Coie sued on the exact same basis when they were the target of a similar executive order, and a judge put a temporary halt on the executive order. And I think that the real power then of these kinds of orders is playing out with the kinds of things that, like what happened last week was reported by the New York Times with another law firm, Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton & Garrison, I think is the full name. This firm was targeted by a bunch of similar executive orders. Instead of fighting back, they sort of came to the table and negotiated with the Trump administration, was like, okay, we will do our legal activities in line with what you want us to. And it seems like that's really the playbook here, is to try to kind of scare and intimidate people into kowtowing to that kind of line. And we're really seeing a breakdown for a lot of big wealthy institutions, not just law firms, but, larger corporations and retailers and universities. A lot of them are just deciding that it is easier to just go along with it than to stand up and challenge it.
Yeah. All right. Now, Illinois Senator Dick Durbin had harsh words for how the Trump administration's officials accidentally shared high-level military information about an attack on Yemen with a journalist via a group chat.
I think they intentionally misled Congress into trying to believe that this was some casual conversation. This is a war plan, and American lives were at risk. And we should deal with it in that seriousness.
So while Illinois' senior senator was tough on the White House for the security breach there, he's also being criticized for backing the Republican spending plan that prevented a government shutdown. So fill us in, Alex, on how progressives are responding to that vote.
Yeah, he defended it along with Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer as kind of a tactical decision to try to swallow what was a bad bill in order to prevent a government shutdown, which they say would have empowered the Trump administration to do even more bad stuff, as they said. But obviously, when you see his constituency and Democrats and liberals of all stripes seeing, especially when they see what we've just been talking about with all of these big, powerful institutions just kind of rolling over, everyone is really thirsty, I think, for someone to just stand up and do some kind of obstruction, stand in the way. And so I think that, unsurprisingly, we saw a massive backlash to Senator Durbin's decision there. Mm-hmm. And it's really bubbling up at and kind of an inflection point for him because he, having just turned 80 years old recently, he's been in the Senate since 1996.
A long time.
And he's going to have to decide very soon whether he's going to run for re-election in 2026. And this is fueling a lot of people who have said, you know, grateful for his service. He's done a lot and been very powerful and effective in his time, but maybe it's time for him to step aside.
Yeah. Do you think, Nader, that this marks the beginning of some growing resistance to the 80-year-old running for a sixth term?
It could. And, you know, we've seen just politically over the last 3, 4, 5, even dating back 10 years since Trump first came to office, there is this growing rift. I think it's generational. It's also ideological between, like, the progressive wing of the Democrats and the more traditional liberal wing. And, you know, the word I was listening to the words that Dick Durbin said, you know, at the start of this. And I mean, he's standing up, he's criticizing the White House. But you also think there are millions of people who could just criticize the White House. He has the privilege of a Senate seat where he could vote and use that power to right. make a change and fight back. And so I think that's just where there's this divide that, you know, people need to step up and do something. That's where you're seeing this right. rift and these protests.
Well, in terms of that chatter about him running, I want to just note here that last week at a press conference, Capital Facts reporter Isabel Miller asked Durbin what factors help him make the decision on whether or not to run again. And he said it came down to his mental and physical health. But specifically, he said, quote, "I still have my wits about me." And also said that he was, quote, "up and moving around, taking nourishment," which I don't know. It doesn't really sound very robust and encouraging.
I just feel like at 80, why would you want to? I should just go, like, I aspire to retirement.
Just being in power
personally.
Is great. you get, look at all this attention and everything. And like he would argue, I think, justifiably that he's really good at his job and has done it well so far and is able to still do it well. But I mean, you'd have to willfully, you know, forget about what the whole country and the Democratic Party just went through with the last president, who was also saying the exact same thing.
Right.
And like, I'm fine. And we saw what happened. And even with things like Dianne Feinstein, who decided to run for a umpteenth term in the Senate and was clearly going through a decline in her later years in a way that kind of marred her legacy, I think. And
yeah,
so these
true.
Have to be things that are going through his head.
Yeah. I want to turn to something very different. Chicago's Catholic Archdiocese is suing a group for falsely accusing a priest of abuse. Help us make sense of this one, Simone.
This is such a sticky story, Sasha. You know, so this revolves around Chicago Catholic priest Daniel McCormick, who, you know, was the subject of many, many lawsuits alleging sexual abuse of young boys. The Archdiocese of Chicago has filed a suit alleging that there is a particular group of people who essentially conspired to bring up false claims in order to get some of the settlement money. Most of the people are anonymous, but they were people who, you know, and they have you know, calls from state prisons or Cook County Jail of this group of people, mostly from the west side of Chicago, talking about trying to, you know, bring a claim and to make money. You know, it's interesting because within this lawsuit, the Archdiocese is not saying, you know, essentially they're not saying that there are no victims, right? They're not saying that, you know, McCormick didn't do anything.
Didn't do anything.
They're just saying in this particular case, they're alleging false claims.
Cook County Treasurer Maria Pappas issued a report saying white, wealthier voters are more likely to vote on property tax referendums. Alex gave us the details.
This is really interesting, and I was happy to see just another in a line of just banger research reports that have come out from the Cook County Treasurer's Office. It is time to talk about the PTEL, the Property Tax Extension Limitation Law.
Ooh, let me get comfortable.
In the state of Illinois, which basically means that if you are not what's called a home rule government, like a big, you know, government like Chicago is, you need to go to voters. You need a ballot referendum in order to raise taxes by more than the rate of inflation or to do any kind of big financial maneuvering, like to say, take out a big bond to build a bunch of stuff. And so what this was focusing on was those specific elections. An example is, you might remember, I think this was in 2022, a question on all of our ballots about whether we wanted to raise the property tax levy from the Cook County Forest Preserves, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. In those situations, you need to go to voters and ask them. And what Treasurer Pappas's office was looking at was, there are really big disparities, and you know, we've known this just in general in terms of voting disparities. If you are wealthier, you sort of have more free time to be a fully active, you know, citizen and look into this stuff and be involved. Mm-hmm. But what the office was looking into is like trying to like bring more attention to is these kinds of things are really important, and I think especially in time with the suburban consolidated election that's coming up this coming Tuesday, just trying to get people to be aware, hey, this is something that really matters. It's probably going to be on your ballots, and it has a lot to do with what you are going to pay in taxes.
Make them aware and then have them follow through, right?
Yeah. Follow through on there's questions of the voters' responsibilities to know what they're voting on and what they're being asked for, and also, frankly, the municipalities' responsibilities to make people aware, to send out educational pamphlets or what have you, or to make sure that everyone knows, hey, here's exactly how much we're asking you to pay, and mm-hmm. here's exactly why and what that's going to be used for. I think that calling attention to the importance of that is a huge aspect of this, and something, one of those down ballot questions that can be very easy to forget about, but
very important.
Impacts us more than a lot of national stuff does, frankly.
And you went a little further. You had your own findings about how misclassified properties cost taxpayers real money, Alex.
So yeah, this was related to property tax assessments, which is related to, you know, what the Cook County assessor thinks that your property is worth so that it can tax you accurately. And so this was a big investigation that we at Illinois Answers Project did with our colleagues at the Chicago Tribune, and found a real disconnect in the process of trying to the assessor's office getting construction permits so that it knows when things have been built so that it can know to tax them properly. And so we found hundreds and hundreds of examples of mansions, apartment complexes, offices that were being taxed as if they were vacant lots because the assessor just didn't know anything that they were anything was built there. And so we wrote a big investigation about it in the summer, and then we just followed up a couple of weeks ago writing about how the assessor's office, in addition to fixing those specific about 500 misclassified properties, putting about $500 million back onto the tax rolls, have also implemented some reforms to try to make sure that that doesn't happen again. So again, it's in this realm of like kind of deep in the weeds tax stuff, but really matters for how much we pay and for our own lives.
I mean, and folks are paying so much attention to what impacts their wallets.
I think it's pretty interesting and pretty exciting.
Hey, and that's why you're the guy to fill us in. Simone, switching gears, CTA workers, they were canvassing L stations Wednesday. They're trying to raise awareness about public transit's fiscal troubles. What's the latest there?
Yeah, so it's actually kind of goes hand in hand with what Alex was saying about like raising awareness about stuff that maybe seems far off or seems wonky, but will actually very much impact you. Folks may have seen late last week, the Regional Transportation Authority, which kind of oversees CTA, Metra, PACE on some level, put out this just sort of terrifying report of, you know, if the state is unable to help them meet this $770 million fiscal cliff, if we can't close this gap, there's going to be massive detrimental cuts to public transit in the Chicagoland area. You know, we're talking about suspending service on half of the L lines. That's just the start.
This,
right?
After we just got the update about the buses becoming more frequent, right? 10 minutes or less.
Yeah.
Then I saw that headline. I thought, wait, what?
Right. Yeah. It would be just truly like transformative, destructive, I should say.
Hope you're enjoying your bus service. Yeah. Be ashamed to see
for 5 minutes.
That's essentially exactly the tone of the report. And you know, to people may have missed that particular reporting. So members of Amalgamated Transit Union Local 308 were canvassing because they were like, these are our jobs that we're talking about that could be lost. Like, CTA riders really need to know that this is kind of what could be coming down the line. You know, I at this point, it's kind of in Springfield's hands to see, you know, what is actually happening financially. I'm sure we've talked about, you know, the proposal to merge these different transit agencies and how that could affect things. But yeah, it is pretty
lots of proposals at the same time. One sort of giving RTA more
one to give RTA
there.
More authority,
and then one putting them all together,
creating a completely new regional transit kind of thing. And again, none of them really getting at, do we have new funding? How are we going to actually deal with the dollars of it all?
Yeah.
You know, what are we going to do there?
Interesting stuff. I want to turn now to a couple of bills. They're aimed at reducing the number of townships in Illinois. How many we got, Alex?
1,426 townships.
That wasn't my real question, but I'm glad
exact.
You were ready. Give us the details on why they want to cut that down.
Well, I mean, Illinois has more units of government by far than any other state in the country. It is a pretty frequent target of, you know, conservatives and sort of the likes of the Chicago Tribune editorial board, who just wrote about it as a pretty easy example of, like, look at all of this wasteful government. And among those voices emerged Governor J.B. Pritzker, who sort of outlined it as one of his priorities earlier this year, a bill to not necessarily abolish these townships, which are sort of an intermediate level of government between municipalities and counties, do some different things. Some of them do things related to tax assessments and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But Pritzker basically not to supported legislation not to necessarily abolish them, but to create more paths for them to be abolished by means of, like, voter referendum and stuff like
that.
I
see. So he's supporting this?
Yes. And the bills that he was supporting just kind of got forgotten and left behind so far in this legislative session. There was a key deadline to move bills out of committee in order for them to continue to be in consideration, and those bills did not make it. I don't have a lot of details about, you know, I'm not a Springfield reporter, what was going on behind the scenes, but intuitively it's just sort of like there are a lot of people who vouch for these township offices and know people who are employed by township offices, including, you know, a lot of Republicans in downstate counties and downstate townships and districts.
It just sounds like a lot, though.
It is a lot.
1,426.
It's a lot of townships, and I think that there's a pretty uncontroversial argument for that's too many. And once you actually start to make decisions of which ones do we shut down, you're going to meet a lot of resistance. If push comes to shove, like, those
that's
are
where
people's
things will get sticky.
Those are people's jobs, you know.
Yeah.
So it shouldn't be surprising that it's facing headwinds, I think.
All right. As always, we cover local media stories in the recap, and this week we've got a couple that have to do with us. Chicago Public Media. I want to start with Wednesday's congressional hearings where CEOs of NPR and PBS testified. Were any of you tuning into any of this? Did you have a chance at all?
I read recaps.
You read recaps?
Yeah, watched some clips.
I did not. I kind of chose to skip it.
Same,
but
dude.
What would you say was the main issue, Nader? Was it whether public broadcasting should still receive federal funding?
Yeah, the chair of the subcommittee that sort of led these hearings is Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene. And, you know, mainstream media has been under attack by the right wing and by the very progressives, too, for many years. But the sort of problem with the hearings here, the sort of crux of the issue, is they say that PBS, NPR, they receive federal funding, they receive the people's money in order to put out news that is way too slanted to the left. That, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene was saying it's not just left-leaning, she's saying it's almost misinformation. It's so left and biased and it can't be fixed and this and that. And so, yeah, there were these hearings basically saying that they want funding to stop going to NPR and to PBS and public broadcasting across the country.
Right.
And there's also, at the same time, a DOJ investigation into, you know, NPR, some member stations around the country, including here at WBEZ, into underwriting practices
right.
that could threaten funding. And, of course, NPR and the member stations have said they believe their practices, you know, have met the standard and met the proper rules and laws. But this is just overall concerted effort to attack the media and public broadcasting. And I think I just want to mention the best quote that I thought
Please.
Came out of that hearing was from a Democratic congressperson who asked the PBS CEO whether Elmo was a communist. And they said, I don't believe so. And they said, are you sure? Because Elmo is red. And they said, no, I don't believe Elmo is a communist. And that sort of just, you know, put into context, it was a little bit of sarcasm, obviously, but put into context, like, where these conversations are happening.
And harkening back to also the 50s with the hearings on the
right.
House Committee on Un-American Activities, sort of like echoing back to that.
Alex and Simone, I mean, let's stay with you two for just a moment. I mean, we've seen the Trump administration taking aim at various media outlets since January 20th when he came back into office. How serious do you both think the threats are to what we do, to journalism right now? Alex?
Oh, man. It's a big question. I think that there's definitely a threat, and I think that it again comes back to sort of the conversation that we were having about those law firms. I think that a lot of media organizations are now, it's time for them to face a kind of existential question of if we are relying on federal money or federal resources, are we willing to compromise our values in order to do that? Or are we going to try to take the difficult road and take some risks and try to just continue to do what we're doing and fight back? Mm-hmm. I have been personally really inspired by a lot of the really, really unapologetic, powerful and investigative and daily journalism that has been happening, keeping Trump, the administration accountable, regardless of these threats.
Right.
But yeah, that's sort of the way that I'm thinking of it.
Yeah, that's the way I'm plugging ahead to. It's the accountability piece. Simone?
Well, it's not just public media, you know, and this media where you might have, or nonprofit media where you might have a federal grant or something, right? You also have to think about private media that relies on advertisers. And if advertisers are spooked about supporting you because they think your voice is a certain thing, that mm-hmm. because of they want to do business in this climate too, like there are knock-on effects across the entire industry
Absolutely.
To worry about as well.
Yeah. Nader, the Chicago Sun-Times also made headlines. This was for ending a tradition that's been around for the paper's more than 75-year history. So as co-chair of the paper's Guild of Journalists, shed some light on this.
Yeah, the Sun-Times, you know, we just went through some pretty significant buyouts. We lost about 20% of our newsroom and a lot of really cherished colleagues. And three of those people were on the editorial board. And so mm-hmm. The couple that remain are sort of moving to other responsibilities, and the Sun-Times isn't publishing editorials anymore. Mm-hmm. And it's a big loss. Like, the Sun-Times editorial board is very racially diverse, I guess was at this point racially diverse.
Right.
In a city that doesn't really have other racially diverse editorial boards. And there have been, you know, questions of what is the role of an editorial board these days? You know, should there be this like group of people at a newspaper that puts out their thoughts
yeah.
and influences decisions? But it does have value still in having expert journalists who have covered their cities for a long time, who come together, have debate. They don't always agree,
right.
but they come together and put out, you know, their view of something.
And I want to share yeah. our chief content officer, Tracy Brown's words, because this was published. This news was announced in the paper from Tracy. And she says, quote, editorials are traditionally unsigned. And when trust in journalism is so precarious, we believe it is essential for our readers to understand exactly who is speaking to them. End quote.
Yeah, you know, there has been legitimate talk of, you know, like I said, the value of editorials. I think, you know, you can go on the website and see, or in the paper at the bottom, you see who is on the editorial board. So you know the names. But, you know, now we have the Tribune editorial board that Alex mentioned earlier. Right. There's the Crane's editorial board. And I saw Lorraine Forte, you know, our departed from the Sun-Times editor of the opinion page. You know, she was saying, like, we do need this diversity of voices from editorial boards even in the city so that it's not just, you know, pro-business or a little bit more conservative editorial boards like the Tribune and Crane's boards might be, but also having the Sun-Times one, which has been a little bit more of a liberal and working class voice. So mm-hmm. it's a tough conversation.
Very, very tough. Yeah. Well, in the 30 seconds I got here, Simone, give us some good news. I can't do my best
Jacoby. Jacoby's not here. It's tough, but I've got some good news.
1,000 things we love about Chicago.
Yeah, so CityCast Chicago put out a list this week of 1,000 things we love about Chicago. It is exactly what it sounds like. It is a list of 1,000 things. Number 649, the Harold Washington Cultural Center. Number 827, watching the planes fly at sunset. At mm-hmm. Horner Hill Park. We collected them from our staff and from our audience. It is way more fun than you think it's going to be to read it. Let me just say that. It was so fun to put together.
Yeah,
and it
sounds like a massive undertaking.
It took us 5 months, actually,
Jeez.
To write 1,000 things. I've never written a numbered list that was so difficult.
Well, check that out. CityCast Chicago, folks. That's it for the weekly news recap. My thanks to Simone Alisea of CityCast, Alex Nitkin of the Illinois Answers Project, and Nader Issa of the Sun-Times. Thank you all so much.
Hey, thanks, Sasha.
Happy Friday.
Have a good weekend.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guthman. It was edited by Maha Ahmed and mixed by Ari Mejia. Every Friday, Reset brings you the news you need to know in under an hour. If you want more Reset throughout the week, sign up for our newsletter. It comes out on Mondays and Fridays, and you can subscribe at wbez.org/reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Have a good weekend, and thanks for listening.
My name is Donald. I live on the southeast side of Chicago. I support WBEZ because of the balanced reporting and covering so much about an issue as opposed to just the few seconds that you may hear on most other news outlets. It matters to me to hear the story more completely.